Nebenstimmen. A podcast by Ensemble Modern. Nebenstimmen brings you conversations on music, art and life between ensemble members and conversation partners chosen by them. Find out what the musicians are working on at the moment and what their personal thoughts are.
Hello and welcome to Nebenstimmen. My name is Paul Cannon. I'm the double bass player of Ensemble Modern. I am very excited today to introduce and welcome my good friend Vimbai Kazaboni. Vimbai and I have known each other for close to 10 years now, I think. Vimbai, welcome to the program. Welcome to Frankfurt. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
And specifically, our listeners don't know, but we're right now sitting in the conductor's room on the first floor of our Fabrique. This happens to be exactly the first place we met.
That's right. That's right.
9 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
We need to talk a little bit about you and your journey through life. I think your background happens to be one of the most interesting and one of the most varied experiences that I know, at least personally. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you've been, where you're going? Where were you born?
Oh, that's a good place to start, I suppose. Yeah.
Start really at the beginning.
Right, at the very beginning. Yes, well, I was born in Zimbabwe, and I lived the first 13 years of my life in Zimbabwe before moving to the US in 2001.
So how old were you when you moved?
Yeah, 13, December 2001. I was 13.
December 2001.
Yeah, yeah.
So you grew up in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
What brought you to the US?
You know, I don't know if you know the history of my country, but there was...
A bit, but...
Yeah,
there was... Pretend I don't know anything.
Yeah, there was quite a big catastrophe at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, which lasted for decades plus, a decade plus at least. Political strife that became economic strife. So by the time, around the time that we left, my mother, I think, had the foresight to see what was coming. And it was kind of right in the right time. She was a graduate student in the USA, and she decided it was important for us to come with her and join her there to avoid what is inevitably a huge catastrophe in Zimbabwe.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I can get more into that. I mean, we had a hero, a president who became an anti-hero, who became a dictator, and that affected, of course, how the country was perceived outside of the country, and with sanctions which affected the economy, which affected everyone. So yeah, and there was a huge chaos after that.
Have you been back to Zimbabwe since then?
Yeah, I first went back after, I guess, almost 10 years, I suppose, in 2010. I still have some family there. Most of my extended family did leave and to avoid the chaos.
Did they all go to the US?
No. All over? Just my mother moved to the US. I've, you know, family who moved to South Africa, family who moved to Europe, to the UK in particular, to Australia. A lot of the Commonwealth countries.
Okay.
Because at the time, we're part of the Commonwealth.
So right. Yeah, of course.
So it was easier then to go to the Commonwealth countries.
Okay. But your parents chose not only the U.S., but where exactly in the U.S.?
My mother was a grad student in Long Beach. So we're in Long Beach for the first year or so, and then Riverside, California, for the first 2.5 years of my existence in the U.S. And then we moved to Nebraska.
Nebraska.
My favorite place in the world. When you and I speak about Nebraska, we're ironic about it, but I just love that place. It's not the place as much as it's the people. Mm-hmm. And you know this about the Midwest, Paul, Midwest of America. There's a certain energy, certain quality that comes with like the people there. There's a lot of nothing, right?
It's very flat and
right.
Very plain. I have to admit,
right.
I haven't spent so much time in Nebraska.
I see, yeah. Well, I've no one does.
Passed through, as many people do.
As most people do, yeah. There's a lot of nothing, and therefore all you have is each other.
Uh-huh.
And there's something that's beautiful about that. I really learned how to be human in Nebraska. I think I attribute that to being Nebraskan more than African. That aspect of just all you have is people.
Okay.
There's not much fun to be, you know. You can go play with the hay, of course, but, you know.
Okay.
But it's all you have is each other, and you learn how to... It was a great place for me. I only lived there for about 3 years, but it's an important place for me, the one that I always go back to.
But you've told me before that the friends that you made...
Are lifelong friends.
Those are lifelong friends, and you've told me you actually visit quite regularly.
Every holiday.
That's amazing to me.
Every time I'm free, I'm in Nebraska.
I mean, for myself, like I almost never go back to the U.S.
Right.
I just went for the first time in 5 years.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And I mean, unfortunately, most of the friends I did have when I was a teenager, I've lost touch with.
Or I see.
We've all gone our separate ways. So I think that's pretty amazing. Yeah. Particularly for you, who's so well-traveled,
right.
And you're all over the world, but you still make the point... Yeah. Almost like a pilgrimage.
Yes, it's also grounding. I think it's going home. Uh-huh. It's very grounding. I travel a lot. I travel for work. Every week I'm traveling. And so the idea of travel is synonymous with work for me. It's tiring, right? It's very tiring. However, going to Nebraska and just doing nothing with your friends, just talking. And it's also one of those places where I'm a child again. That's another great point is I'm... My friends don't care about what I've done. They're proud of me. My friends are very proud of me, but they don't care. They care about me.
Uh-huh.
They care about the person. So there's something that's, I think, grounding about that and loving. I don't know.
No, that's good. And I mean, it's, as you know, it's very easy to get sucked into social bubbles and cliques.
Right.
And especially as a musician, from time to time I notice like, oh, I don't have so many non-musician friends,
actually
people that I'm close with.
Yeah.
And the ones I did have were from those teenage years who I lost touch with.
Right. Yeah.
So good for you.
Yeah. No, it's a gift. It's a gift. Yeah.
At what point did you find yourself gravitating towards music?
Oh, early on when in Zimbabwe, my first instrument, I was 5 or 6. I was playing the mbira. You know what
that is? Yeah. Is it a musical family?
No. However, I hear that my late paternal grandfather, whom I never met, he was a high school principal. I come from a family of teachers, for the most part. My mother was a school teacher. Both my grandmothers were school teachers. My paternal grandfather was a teacher and then became high school principal. Both my parents were at some point teachers. My aunts and uncles, professors and teachers. I come from a family of teachers. However, my paternal grandfather, whom I never met, he passed away before I was born. I was told he was a choir director once, like, you know, amateur choir director, high school. Like, and I believe he did it because someone quit their job or someone left. So he did it for. But I come, you know, my both my grandmothers, you know, sang in church choirs and things like this. I sang in a boys' choir when I was young. Up until I moved to the U.S., I sang in a boys' choir.
Now, I understood your first primary instrument was percussion.
Yes, mbira, then percussion. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, but all up until end of undergrad.
But do you still play sometimes?
Sometimes I'll play chima music with my students.
Okay.
As part of teaching, which is great. And the older I get, the more out of touch I get with percussion, the more fascinating it becomes.
Okay.
Because like, what are these two things in my hands, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. So that's fun. And it's a great way to be in touch with teaching. It's a great way, just doing.
To play with your students.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I love playing for my conducting students, for example. I love playing for them. When I'm coaching chima music, to play percussion with them, that's always fun.
Where are you teaching, by the way?
At Boston Conservatory at Berkeley.
Boston Conservatory at Berkeley.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it's called. Okay.
Yeah.
How long have you been there?
This is my fifth year now.
Your fifth?
Yeah.
So, I don't know if I want to get on that topic now, but, so you survived Corona and everything through that. That must have been wild.
That was wild. Yeah. Because of course you're conducting ensembles and things like this. And then when COVID came, we had students making recordings of their parts and like trying to put it together just to like somehow stay in touch with it. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, some composers started writing music for, you know, for the medium, for Zoom. There's a great piece that I love by Dai Fujikura called Longing From Afar.
Longing from Afar by Dai Fujikura.
Yes, okay. Yes. Beautiful piece, I think, in which he wrote it particularly for to be played on Zoom.
On Zoom in particular. It doesn't work on Skype.
Well, I haven't used Skype in more than a decade.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has.
Yeah. But on Zoom, you can see each other. So there's a conductor, there's musicians. Mm-hmm. You can see the conductor's gestures. You decide the form ahead of time or impromptu. And everyone is recording themselves. As they are playing together on Zoom, everyone is also recording their audio and their video at home on a second device. And then after you play together, you put those two... You put all the recordings together and it's a piece of music, yeah.
And I suppose though we'd be playing with time delays and this kind of effect.
Right. It's cool. But I think that comes with the aesthetic, yeah.
Well, we got a little off topic
here,
but also tangent. Interesting. So you did your college studies first in the U.S.
In Los Angeles, yeah.
In Los Angeles.
USC, Southern California, yeah.
Uh-huh. And that was on percussion, or you were already studying conductor?
I knew I wanted to be a conductor. I knew I wanted to be a conductor quite early on. Okay. I had a lot of teachers when I was in high school and things like this who kept saying, you have to be a conductor, you have to be a conductor. I had enough of a gift, musical capacity. I was always engaging my teachers in musical conversations, like the musical topics, like, you know, having interesting conversations in that regard. And I think I always had also the kind of personality traits socially that are important with conducting. And also the standards, the musical standards that one expects on themselves and on others. So I think that's in a very complicated recipe to how to become a conductor, those are some of the ingredients. So very early on, I was playing percussion, you know, in the back of the orchestra. I played timpani for the most part. You're back in the back of the orchestra, and sometimes you're resting. And so I always had the score with me. I was always interested about the global picture. And that really got me into an interest into conducting. I was also interested in composition, but more so in how, like, what's Beethoven doing, right? Mm-hmm. That, to me, studying composition was... trying to understand the composer's mind. So that happened very early on, and thanks to being a percussionist in the back of the orchestra, bored, you know.
So I know, because you're very often working as a guest with Ensemble Moderne, right. and with a number of other contemporary ensembles, one could refer to you as a new music specialist,
right.
Certainly. Are you also conducting classical repertoire and
yes, absolutely.
Older repertoire as well?
Older repertoire as well. I'm a Beethoven fanatic, uh-huh. among other composers. He was one of those early, you know, I don't know if you feel have the same relationship with the composers you loved early on, Paul.
Oh, who does?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, such as myself, had an angsty teenage period,
right.
Obsessed with Shostakovich.
Okay, so Shostakovich was big for me, but Beethoven more so. Beethoven and Cage, I met at the same time. I was like 13 or so. I think right when I moved here, I discovered Beethoven and Cage around the same time. Mm-hmm. Cage, because I was a percussionist, so like the kind of percussion music we revere, the quartets, for example, are really incredible. So that's actually one way that I got into new music, being a percussionist, because our repertoire is mostly new music, right? Like the virtuosic repertoire. Yep. But Beethoven, I was just in love with, he spoke to me in a very like visceral way. Like I understood Beethoven before I understood Beethoven.
I
got Beethoven, like you love your favorite punk band, you know?
Uh-huh.
You don't care about the theory. You don't care about like,
right.
What are they doing? Whoa, that was a crazy progression. No, you just like, you feel
it's just
something.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's fun and it's satisfying to listen to. It's,
yes.
Yeah, sure.
And so I've had that relationship with Beethoven. Therefore, in my studies, I was studying those composers and I've been pursuing those composers in addition to specializing in.
But has all of your specialization in new music, has that colored your perception of that older repertoire?
Absolutely. When I go to Beethoven and talk about color, who talks about color when they talk about Beethoven? Mm. I'm obsessed with that. When I talk to strings, I'm interested about where, what part of the bow you're on, mm-hmm. in Beethoven, or on a Dvorak slow movement. I'm Are you towards the bridge, away from the bridge? Flautando, how fast is your ball? How light out? I'm more interested in that, but that all comes from new music. That's that's all stuff that I learned from new music. Also, being a percussionist, you think about color a lot. Okay. Do you know the I think it's Bruckner 9. Do you know Boulez's Bruckner 9?
I never heard that recording. No.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I don't think...
I love his Mahler recordings.
Yeah. Right, of course. Well, so Bruckner is, you know, I don't know. It's worth listening to. Check it out. Okay. Because, yeah, you know, his Boulez coming to this repertoire. So he's not about this kind of... He's less concerned about this kind of romantic expressionism. He's more interested about the other things, which I think he's bringing as a composer, but also as a new music practitioner.
Now, I don't know if this is something you would agree with, but as an instrumentalist and as an interpreter,
right.
Having worked with so many living composers and more experimental composers in particular, I think that's given me a very different perspective on the mentality of composers and their process. Mm. I mean, some of them always know exactly what they want, or at least they project that.
Right.
but so many of the composers we work with are constantly changing their minds. Right. They're making additions and subtractions and actually sometimes very radical changes, which you wouldn't possibly understand from the score. Mm. And you have to be in the room with them and have that conversation and they have to test stuff out and try things. And that's the funny thing, then, to work on that older repertoire and to hear someone talking about, we have to respect the text, this is the holy Beethoven score, and this is the Urtext Baron Reiter version, that it has to be this note and this stroke, and that's the only way it could possibly be.
Right.
Well, how do you know that?
So, this is the fun part of the work that you and I do, isn't it? Like, we're in the room, and we're you know, the horse's mouth. We're right with the horse's mouth. And I think also with our teaching, we both teach. And I think it affects that, right? To say, actually, this is what the composer meant when they wrote this. So actually, you know, I love Xenakis as a composer. And I was doing a piece years ago, maybe a decade ago, called Anactoria.
Yeah.
And
great piece.
Yeah, I love that piece. Talk about angst. Mm. And he writes, he's talking about the bridge sound. He just writes bridge sound in the score. And then we thought maybe it's over pressure, or maybe he wants it on the bridge.
No, you take it to the bridge.
It's
the pre-chorus.
Yeah, that's good. Is that a funk reference? You just make a funk reference?
Maybe.
That's incredible. So anyway, he writes to the bridge. So if you didn't know anything about Xenakis, if you didn't know that he was erroneously saying bridge sound, although he wanted something else, you have to guess what Aditi was in the room. Aditi knows what Xenakis meant.
Uh-huh.
So I had to read this book. I was reading this book by Aditi about Xenakis, and he writes this about what Xenakis really means by bridge sound, and that changed my interpretation of how to play a Xenakis piece.
But, you know, that's such a frustrating thing, actually, that,
right.
You know... I mean, it's a real privilege for me to be in Ensemble Moderne, and we play these classic pieces,
right.
And there's all of this institutional knowledge.
Yeah, Ligeti, for example, is
Ligeti
great.
Is a huge one for us, that we'll be playing the camera concert, the chamber concert, and half of the guys in the room rehearsed that with
Ligeti, yes.
Many times, in fact, and recorded it. And
there's a famous video in the Anbau with Ligeti doing, I think they're doing the piano concerto with Uli, and Ligeti was right there, and you know.
I mean, there's so many stories.
It's crazy, of course.
It's a great recording, by the way.
Yeah.
Long before my time, but the thing is, we'll be rehearsing, and Uwe, our trombonist, just says, well, Ligeti actually told me to do this.
Right.
And it's a little bit frustrating, because it's like, well, that's not what's in the score. You just have a special permission slip.
Right. But think about this. I think I used to get frustrated by these things until I thought about my first teacher, whom I love dearly, Lucinda Carver, was an early music specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And she was my first true teacher. And when Bach writes in the Sinfonia, sometimes there's no dynamics. I mean, the Urtext edition, we have dynamics, but that's a guy who edited this. But there's so much that's missing from the page.
Right.
When Bach is writing, or any of those early guys, all the way up to Wagner. Like, I mean, even in Wagner, one could argue that, like, actually there's not enough information. And you are a Puccini, you know, I mean, that's the reason why people like Mahler were kind of overcorrecting by trying to put everything so that people in the future can really.
And it's still understand. Not clear.
And exactly.
Because it doesn't matter without context. Contradictions.
Right.
You know, you're writing that for particular musicians.
Right.
Music generally has been going more and more in that direction. It becomes very personalized.
Absolutely. So there's something to be said about tradition. Why do we respect the early music tradition or the classical tradition, even though it really relies on, or who did you study with? Or the teacher who you studied with told you that this is how you play the Koussevitzky bass concerto, this is how you play Beethoven in the right way.
Yeah.
The
one and only way.
Right. H.I.P., when H.I.P. came in the 70s, 80s.
Historically informed performance.
Exactly, yes. And when that came, like, you know, you're these experts, right? So suddenly there were these experts, you know, these scholars were saying, this is how they would have done it because they read some treatise, or this is how maybe they would have done it. So it's happening now
Which has value. I mean, that's based on research.
So come to modernist repertoire. It's happening now, right? So the thing is that what's needed is a more kind of official way of to officialize this historical knowledge.
No, absolutely, and it's very frustrating. I mean, if you do Ligeti or Stockhausen is a big example. That's such specific information,
right?
And there is the correct historical way, and there's really only a few people who know.
No, right.
So it has become historical music, actually.
But you guys are doing your part. I mean, you have what now? Almost 20 years worth of students?
We're on the 20th year.
Yeah, in your academy, you have 20 years, generations worth of musicians who have learned or who are learning this tradition from people who really know.
Well, this is an excellent segue to one of my questions. As we're going along the Vimbaya Kazaboni life journey, after USC, you would have come to Frankfurt.
That's right, yeah. You know, I started when I was at USC as an undergrad, I started an ensemble with my friend John Schultz, who plays, he's a violist in Anticontemporary.
Right, we know him, yeah.
My closest musical friend. So we're doing many things together. Right before coming to Germany, the year before, we both somehow got accepted to, remember this summer academy that Ensemble Modern used to lead in Schwaz, in Klangspuren.
Right.
We both went that year, and George Benjamin was the guest that year, the biggest. So, and that was a crucial summer for me, Paul. Because I was into conducting. I mean, when you're a young conductor, you're figuring a lot out in yourself. It's a lot of self-study. I had teachers, I had some experiences because I had an ensemble, but a lot of the issues you're just figuring out yourself. You learn the most in those early years. Like you learn a lot. But that summer was the first time, after having been conducting for about 3 or 4 years with serious study, was the first time that I conducted a piece where I knew everything in the score, every single detail in the score. And that changed my life. That moment changed my life.
Which piece was that?
George Benjamin, Ole Cantus.
Okay.
Do you know this piece?
I haven't played that, no.
A short piece, 6 minutes maybe.
Okay.
For ensemble. And of course, the reason why I managed to get to the smallest detail of that piece because I had George Benjamin right next to me teaching me about the piece. And he would break things apart. We'd study together privately, like take a walk in the mountains with George. Like we're talking about music, and then in the rehearsal, he would like slow things down. He's just like, let's just hear the chimes, like one note, and then a minute later, there's another note, and then you put all the notes together. Oh, that's Happy Birthday to You. He's a piece he wrote for Oliver Newsom. You're figuring all these connections out. Going so deeply into a piece, and that was the moment in which I was like, if ever I wasn't sure about wanting to be a conductor, that was the moment I was like, when you really know everything, when you really have mastered the score, it's the feeling is really incredible, and the exchange that you have with musicians is much more profound.
Yeah,
you know, they, knowledge gives you a certain degree of authority.
Right.
Yeah, it's very empowering. And then when you have a good relationship with the musicians, it becomes much more beautiful, profound conversation.
Okay.
So that changed me. That's how I knew I wanted to go study with Sam Modin. That's how I knew.
Okay.
New music was my thing. That's how I knew I wanted to become a conductor.
Tell me a little bit about your year. Yeah. You had a year residency basically with our academy.
Right.
And that's incidentally when I started coming as a guest.
That's right.
To the ensemble. So that's when we met.
Right. That's when we had the beautiful conversation right where we're sitting.
Yes, exactly. We had a long conversation about conducting. And all of our ideals and our bright eyes towards the future. How young we were.
Yeah.
But I'm curious. I mean, that's an intense year.
Yes.
As far as I can tell. And
Yes.
That's a program now. I've been helping to run the last few years, and I see actually how much work that is for the students, and it's very intense.
Yeah,
I think it's very surprising, and it's a shock to the system in a lot of cases that they didn't know actually you can work that much, and it's not even as much as the Ensemble Modern is working, but you have to build up to that.
That's right.
And I'm curious. Are there some experiences or maybe some lessons? What happened during that year that's really stuck with you?
Oh, my gosh. That's when I really became a musician. I grew so much in that year. First of all, I mean, just the scores they sent you before you start, it's intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually, I don't know if you're still doing this, Paul. When I was doing, my year was special because it was the 10th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So there were more concerts than usual. There was more touring than usual. It was intense. It was intense. So the scores that they sent you to start with is like, you know, the modernist classics. They send you like 10 scores or something like that will happen in the first phase. So that, you know, kind of an orientation of modernist music. And then with a few contemporary pieces as well.
Yep.
And a classical piece back then, there was also like a classical piece just to like, you know, to get to know each other musically. I think we did one of the Brandenburg concertos then.
The basic concept is still there. I wouldn't do the Brandenburg concerto, but we try to give as a big a picture as possible because that's our experience as an ensemble, that contemporary music can be almost anything if it can be notated.
Yes.
And if it's physically possible to play, or even physically possible to consider playing, we will try.
But even your repertoire, I mean, remember that first year that you were on trial with Mozart Grand Partita?
My very first project with the Ensemble Modern. I was playing Mozart.
Bam. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was intense. I think I was one of the youngest. Two of us, me and Diego, were the youngest in the whole crew. So some of the crew was like 10 years older than I was, and I was the conductor, you know.
I know.
It's a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. But I think with a really intense bond, the musicians and I, that year, part of that is like the trauma of just doing is a lot of music, a lot of new music. I don't know if you guys still do this.
Trauma, that's an interesting
choice. Yes, oh yeah. And of course, now I look at it fondly. I love from, this is my musical home, and Ensemble Modern is my home musically. And I look at it so fondly, but that year it was, you know, just you're really buried in these scores, and you have to know every score. Like
you're the soldiers in the trenches.
That's the thing.
I mean, it when it gets really intense, it feels like you're going to battle.
So we're there for each other, which was great, which was a kind of a beautiful thing to see with music making, which I'd not really experienced. Like the idea of like we're there for each other musically. That's to me, that's still a beautiful profound concept.
Okay.
That when things get tough musically, we're there for each other. No one dies, you know. It's still music, and it's sharing. We're here together. So that was a big thing. Like I made lifelong friends during that experience. There were so many of us from all over the world. It was a very international group. So we're sharing in all aspects of life, but also musical aesthetics. So our big final exam concert, in which we curate ourselves, was very, very, very diverse. It was like, there was like theater, there was very old music, very new music, there was the classics. There was so much happening that I would have never imagined before coming here. And then all the tours that we did, just, you know, you feel like celebrities, like we're small and some more then, like when you're, you know, so there's something that's very empowering about the experience, not just surviving it, but you're also empowered by knowing that, oh, I can do this. Right now, I'm here in Europe for 2 months and I have like 22 scores right now. I have like 22, 23 scores that I'll be doing in the next couple months.
Yeah.
I could not have done that before EMA. It was impossible. It's crazy.
Yeah, you have to be put in a situation where you're forced to do it.
Right.
And at that point, you actually do see what your limits are.
Right.
And you see what you're able to do. You find a way to work efficiently.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I call it, pick your battles. Right. you kind of leaf through the scores and you see, okay, this one's easy. I can deal with that later. Right. That's going to be a problem.
Right. So going back to Benjamin, going back to George and doing all the cantos, I feel like I would have never understood a Mahler symphony truly before understanding that little 6-minute piece. Mm. So to a point you're making right now about like understanding what picking your battles. So to me, it's always about how will I get to the musical essence of this piece? What's fundamentally being said in this piece that I have to project to the musicians, that we have to project to the audience? I have to do that with every piece, all the scores that I'm doing, and mastering, I guess that's the word, mastering that one little small piece, 6-minute piece that I just adore, was kind of the gateway into now I can master 25 scores. You know, in the coming months, however many, that was a crucial aspect. Just like asking yourself the right fundamental question, and then there's a whole group of questions around that question to understand the piece. So organizing yourself, and you guys do this a lot. I mean, you're also touring. Another element of what you guys do is you get back the piece from 2 years ago. And then you have one rehearsal to get it back. We're doing that soon in Cologne.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you're there yet. I'm there.
Thank you for reminding me.
we literally last did that piece 2 years ago.
But I'm always amazed. I mean, I surprise myself as well. There's so many pieces where they come up and we have no rehearsal time.
Right.
And I'm really doubting, like, do I remember this piece? Right. Do I have any idea how to do this? There's no time to rehearse. There's hardly any time to practice.
Right.
And then we sit down for the one rehearsal, we run through the piece, and it's all in the fingers.
Right.
It's all still there.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we had that experience just yesterday.
Oh, yes.
At the time of this recording, yesterday we had a performance of Heiner Goebbels' House of Call.
Yes.
With the Ensemble Moderne Orchestra.
Right.
Here in Frankfurt, and we had performed it many times before, and we had performed it just, I think, 2 or 3 months ago in the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. And then yesterday, we just had a general rehearsal, one run-through, and then a concert directly after.
Yep.
And I had this sinking fear in my gut when I sat down for the rehearsal. I'm not sure if I remember this piece. There's just that doubt. And as soon as it started, it just all flooded back as if we had just rehearsed it yesterday. And it's amazing, actually.
I mean, that's crazy because that's like 70 people having the same feeling.
Yes.
That's another crazy
thing. It's a group group situation.
With just the ensemble, the core ensemble, we trust each other very much.
Yeah.
There's a lot of trust. And you guys play every day together. But within this kind of much bigger, much more broader ensemble, 70 musicians or so, it's everyone has to have that feeling and that trust that they remember the piece. And it worked out. And it was a great, maybe one of our best performances of that piece. Yeah, it was terrific. And that was, you know, with just a dress rehearsal.
I have to throw in a short anecdote from yesterday, from this Heiner Goebbels' performance. After the concert, some of us snuck off to the cafe across the street. and there were... there were quite a few people from the audience who afterwards went to the same cafe. And I met a gentleman who told me he thought he was going to see the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto.
Come on.
Because he misread the date, and he really wanted to see Rachmaninoff, so he went and sat down, and then the show started, and he realized slowly, wait a minute.
This is not Rachmaninoff.
And he said he had 1 or 2 minutes kind of upset with himself for being stupid and misreading the calendar. And after that, he thought, oh, actually, this is way cooler. This is a very interesting thing. And actually such a... Well, he didn't say this. Now I'm just projecting my own thoughts into his brain. Actually, this is a rare treat.
Right.
Because Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto, I mean, it's a nice piece.
Yeah.
It's a well-loved piece. And it's one of those war horses that gets trotted out pretty often.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's a piece you want to see live, it's not difficult to find.
Oh, yeah. Twice on Sundays. I mean, it's easy.
I mean, especially here in Germany, there's so many orchestras and concerts just everywhere. I'm sure any given weekend... within a 3-hour train ride, you can find Rachmaninoff Third somewhere. Yeah. But Heiner Goebbels' A House of Call, which is an extremely interesting piece, with quite a beautiful light installation by the composer, conceptually very, very special.
Yeah.
And that's just not something you're going to see too often, because it's a very complicated piece. It's a complicated setup. It's theatrical. And it's not easy.
Right.
So
inexpensive, very
expensive. It's expensive, and it's not the kind of thing most orchestras are so interested.
Right.
Because it's not the easy war horse like Rachmaninoff Third.
Right.
They would need to practice, they would need to rehearse. So not easy.
Yeah.
we had the luxury of all those tryouts.
Yeah, I mean, over the course of 4 years.
Over years. We built this piece up, and as we were talking about earlier, all these very small changes that happened through that process, which we have in our parts, which are not in the score, by the way. So it's a special thing to see.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, isn't that what's exciting about new music, particularly when new music is done very well, right? Particularly when new music is done with kind of the sincerity of how we perceive old music, right? This kind of like, I'm really going for it. I'm putting everything on this, which I believe, and Heiner is a dear friend now. And, you know, we talk about these things. That's a piece that really represents like kind of his philosophy about art in general.
Right.
His aesthetics about music, it's like there's so much that
it's a very personal piece.
It's a very personal piece. It's a very personal, the subtitle is actually My Imaginary Notebook.
Yeah.
Is how he subtitles it. So you all are the Goebbels experts, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm currently learning Black on White.
Oh, yes.
Schwarz auf Weiß. I get my first shot at it just in a few days, actually.
That's incredible. That's his first masterpiece. That's what put him on kind of the map.
I mean, it was the first big success with the ensemble and him together, as far as I'm aware.
Yes, it very much,
And again, institutional memory. I mean, those parts I was given are not clear. so that's one that has to be put together every time and bit of a delicate thing. Let's continue the journey. So you were here in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, you did something. I don't know anyone else who has done something quite like it. Where did you go, Vimbai?
I think you're making fun of me at the time. Also.
No. Where did you go?
This was crucial. I want to go back to George Benjamin Schwartz in Tirol, when Klangspuren. I met a young conductor, youngish conductor at this point, from Uzbekistan. No, actually, I met him prior in Salzburg. I'd met him a few months prior. And then in Klangspuren, three musicians from his band, from my Uzbek colleagues' band, were part of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
A cellist, a bassist, and a violinist. And so the second time I'm meeting these Uzbek musicians, and I'm kind of fascinated. Uzbekistan is a country that I couldn't tell you where it is on the map.
Right.
I could guess. I mean,
we're both American citizens here, and I think the world knows we're not the first experts in geography.
Geography, yeah. Yes, I mean, so despite that ignorance, I just couldn't tell you Uzbekistan was. But the conversation that I had with the conductor in Salzburg prior was incredible. This was like musicians, people in music leadership, and I think we're the only two young conductors at this place, and we're both in new music. We both had ensembles in our hometowns, so we had much to connect on. And I just loved his approach to talking about music. Whenever you talk to, at least when my experience is talking to Westerners about new music particularly, there's always they always show their aesthetic politics, right? Oh, you like this composer? Psh, oh, that's, you know, I prefer this one. You know, this is the true master, blah, blah. There's always kind of that personalized kind of aesthetic values that are put into. He just spoke about music like everything was just open.
Right.
There was, yeah, anything I would play for him like the most conservative music that I knew, just to test him, and he'd be just in love with it. He would just find something that he's just in love with.
But do you think that was reflective of a larger cultural trend, or that was just him and he's special?
Maybe. I ignored it. Don't worry. I just thought I found a special person. Yeah. But fast forward, now in Klangspuren, and I meet the musicians from his band, three of these musicians, and they have the same kind of openness. The same kind of openness, not just personally, just about music, about we're doing. I think among the pieces we did was Anactoria, actually, here. And they were just really into it. And they were the bass and cellos were playing on this piece. And they were the most into it. They were you could see them physically into it. Like really, really expressing it. Like when you see someone play Wagner, someone play a romantic, they were really into it. And Anactoria is ugly music.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea. It's ugly. It's perverse. It's in your face.
It's intense.
It's intense music. And they really were so I was blown away by this.
Okay.
So I started talking to them more, and there was a bit of language barriers, but from what I could get from them, there was just this love for anything that you're doing. Anything that you have committed to, there was just this love that they exuded. So I was curious. I became very curious. So I applied for a Fulbright to Uzbekistan. I got it. I don't know how many applicants apply for Fulbright to Uzbekistan.
Probably not so many, but generally Fulbright is I mean, that's an American scholarship.
Right.
Actually came out of the Marshall Plan.
That's right.
It has an old history.
Being in Germany, it's...
I mean, and it's about cultural exchange.
Right.
Which... I mean, at some point, I was hoping that would be what we're really talking about today.
Yes.
Yeah, that Fulbright scholarship, that is actually the point of having a cultural exchange and a real exchange.
Well, that's... I had a life-transforming exchange, cultural exchange, in my time in Uzbekistan.
How long were you in Uzbekistan?
Yeah, it was 4 years.
1 year?
Yeah, 1 year in Uzbekistan. I get there. My gosh, Paul, they're doing... Every week is a new crazy project, unfathomable music. They love this Western classics. They love that music. You're in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. And I'm not just talking about the musicians. The audiences love it. Because it's their first time that they're hearing this. They're so open. And the first time they hear Ligeti, we did the cello concerto. And they're just, they're like, oh, it's so beautiful. Oh, the small little sounds.
Really active listeners, actually.
That's the thing. And they're active listeners about every kind of aesthetic. I did a minimalist project, a Michael Gordon opera. Huh. I did all these different kind of projects with them.
Wow, I really want to go to Uzbekistan now.
Paul, let's arrange this.
Okay.
We're going to arrange this. We have to arrange this.
Let's go.
After this, we'll talk about this. That year was their 10th anniversary.
Okay.
The year that I was there. So there were many guests coming from... The guys from Bang on a Can were there. Mm-hmm. Some European musicians were there. So there was a lot of these exchanges happening, and I was just a part of it, and, you know, conducting some works here and there, going to see great art, going to watch their opera projects, all these things that are happening around town. And I was always so moved. The ovations that they have, the audiences have there, they just really, really touched. And there's this deep, deep gratitude for performance, for art that's being made, and that really, really moved me. And you know, it stretches the ear because this ensemble was also interested in like doing research about Uzbek music, which the intonations of their musical language, of their theoretical language, is really, really fascinating. And these guys were working on this.
I don't think I've ever heard it.
Oh, it's worth it. It's worth checking out. Well, maybe next year we'll go.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Let's take a trip.
Yeah. There's one of two things has to happen. We have to go there, but also we're going to somehow make a connection with the ensemble here and do some sort of collaboration with them. Because it'll be really, really incredible. But it was a really, really life-changing thing. So it really opened up my eyes and my ears and my heart to this really kind of alien aesthetics, to someone who became of age musically in the West, you know. Right. So that was really, really transforming for me.
So you were there 1 year.
Yes.
And then, as I recall, you went to Paris. Did I miss a step here?
I moved to New York because
New York.
What do you do when you finish your studies and you live in Uzbekistan?
The last place I would want to go is New York City. But for me,
it was Nebraska or New York.
Okay, fair enough.
Nebraska was the safe choice, was Nebraska. And New York was like the crazy, what am I doing? Choice.
No offense to New York. I recently visited, actually for the first time in my life.
Oh, okay.
Just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I think my fear there is that there's really so much competition, and it's a kill or be killed kind of atmosphere. I mean, that was my impression from the outside.
I think that's a fair characterization.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a fair. But there's also great things happening there. There's great music happening. There's, a competitive atmosphere, but really well-meaning, talented musicians who really go for it and are up for the fight, you know?
Okay.
So I went to, I didn't know what else to do. I just went to New York. You know, that was a thing for a while. Like when you want to make big, go to New York.
Yeah, people say that.
Yeah.
If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
Anyway.
Yeah, there's a song about that, I think.
Frank Sinatra, I think. Yeah. So, yes, I went to New York, and in that year is the year that I was, applying for auditions and things like this. And that's the year I applied to be assistant at Under Contemporane. And that's the year that I went to Paris. Yeah.
So, by now, you've lived in Zimbabwe, California, Nebraska, New York, Frankfurt, Germany, Paris, France, yeah. Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
Am I missing something?
Well, I mean, after Paris, many doors opened.
Yeah.
Not just new music and other avenues as well. Professorships. I got a professorship in Pennsylvania, and 2 years after the one in Boston. Yeah. I think things kind of changed. There was a big shift mm-hmm. that happened around that time, career-wise, for me, with many doors opened that I was, you know, willing to enter.
Well, I just so appreciate having you around and hearing all your stories, even though I've heard some of these stories before, yeah. But there's so much about the value of human contact mm-hmm. with you. And that's always, no matter what we're talking about, that always seems to come through, that you mm-hmm. really value the people sitting in front of you.
Yeah.
We should talk a little bit about some upcoming projects.
Yes.
Because we have quite a few with you these days. We're keeping you busy.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we have an ongoing project called Afro-Modernism in Contemporary Music.
Yes.
That was curated actually by George Lewis.
Yes.
That will be coming up next in Cologne at the Cologne Philharmonie
mm-hmm.
on the 10th of October, 2022. I really should mention the year because sometimes these podcasts stay up for 10 years.
Right.
I don't want to get anyone's hopes up. That program features pieces from Hannah Kendall, Jesse mm. Cox, Daniel Kidane, Alvin Singleton, Adile Kumalo, and Tanya Leon.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to say about that project?
I mean, there's so much to be said, of course. George is my mentor, and I really admired George. Just how he's navigated the world of contemporary music, from a political perspective, I don't know if that's the word, philosophical perspective, I think that's the way to put it, of keeping his soul while navigating, you know, like a treacherous field, like, you know, very competitive field, and really like making a mark, like with his ideas, his compositions, absolutely, but his ideas, just like talking to people about, yeah, guys, let's talk about this thing, this one aspect. Let's talk about this aspect now. I just really admire his approach and I would say his humanity that he brings to music making, generally speaking. And this program is no different from kind of his thoughtfulness with the act of curating.
Right.
So this is a project about where we highlight these six composers from the African diaspora.
Yeah.
So these are composers from all over. There's a South African composer, there's a Swiss composer, there's couple of American composers, yep, Afro-Cuban composer in the case of Tanya, a British composer, two British composers, I think, actually, but all of whom have different stories, different lives that they've lived, and yet kind of what connects them is this kind of living in the world with black skin, a heritage from Africa somehow, from Africa, but through many differing avenues. And how does that manifest itself in art? How does that manifest itself in music?
Right.
And as a result, you see pieces that are vastly, vastly different.
But they have nothing to do with each
Absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely.
I mean, aesthetically, absolutely. I don't catch any common thread.
I love that.
I mean, actually, in a way, it makes an interesting point because the title of the program, it makes it sound like, okay, here's African music.
Yes.
Whatever that means.
Yes.
As if it's just one thing. And actually what you get are six individuals.
Yes.
With their own lived perspectives, their own stories, and they have very different things to say.
Right.
So we've offered this platform to them, and it's a more individual process. So in a way it's a bit of a fake or a decoy.
Yeah. No, I would argue that the most important thing that this program says is the thing about living in black skin is that, and one could say that this is about other groups, but I'm just talking because this the project that we're discussing.
I mean, it's about.
And also my own personal experiences is that it's so easy to be pigeonholed or to be put in this kind of box just by being looked at, right?
Yeah.
And I think what the kind of the big theme here that this program illustrates is that actually these are vastly differing people, different ideas, different lives, different aesthetics. They're all different.
Yeah.
They're connected via this black skin, which is how everyone sees them, but the output itself is very different.
Yeah.
So I really love this program for that idea. And of course, you know, collaborating with the composers, getting to know the composers who were part of this has been a profound experience. And I think also for the ensemble, this is great. I mean, the ensemble has been really doing a lot of work in this regard. I mean, I think one of the early programs that we did together was a program of all women. This is maybe 2017 or 18.
I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. And that was also a fascinating program because none of the pieces sound the same as well.
They have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
I mean, what you get is just, here's some very interesting composers.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think it's important for us anyway because we do have a platform.
Yes.
And in some cases, we have a very large platform.
Of course.
So I think it is important to offer that and offer space to people who maybe have struggled to find a platform.
So here's the thing about that is the main idea, I think this is an important question to ask yourself in the act of curation, now more than ever, because this is part of the public consciousness, is what do I want to say? Yes, that's important. What am I trying to say? But also a consideration, and this has to come from a place of empathy, is, okay, whose stories are not being told?
Right.
There's many stories that we've heard, like kind of the same old stories, right? But whose stories have we not heard? Let's say something new, and this is kind of the questions we're trying to answer. Like, and then as a result, some really fascinating results products. We're hearing music that we don't often hear. It's really expanding our ears and our consciousness. This is, I think, a great way forward.
Speaking of Hannah Kendall, she has another piece which will be premiered at the Donaueschingen Musiktagen, also conducted by you on the 16th of October, 2022. She recently won the Hindemith Prize.
Oh, did she? I didn't know
actually,
that. That's great. Oh, I'm happy for Hannah. That's great.
And that'll be premiered alongside a new work from Georg Friedrich Haas.
Yes.
So I assume you have the new scores.
Yes.
Because I just got my parts.
Just received them, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you do when you get a fresh score?
Yes.
How do you take that apart?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because in the old days, it would have been a conductor would sit down at a piano,
yes,
and read out through the score and get an idea musically what it is. Right. With a piece like the Haas, it doesn't make any sense.
Make sense. Yeah, I mean, imagine Lachenmann. Imagine trying to piano study of Lachenmann score. Right. You know, it's ridiculous. It's about imagination. I going back to my experience with Ole Kantus. And again, asking yourself kind of the big questions, like you're trying to get to the essence of the piece.
Yeah.
So I'm going through the piece trying to see, okay, what are the materials? What are the fundamental materials? Like the first thing that's said. And then how are those materials being developed? That's kind of what I'm looking for. Before I'm thinking about, how hard is this for the bass player? I'm not thinking about that yet. I'm just thinking about what's the composer trying to say? And, you know, that's a process that takes a long while because you get deeper and deeper and deeper. But that's kind of superficial. I'm just trying to say, okay, what are they working with here, and what do they do with it? Where do they go with it? Where do we end up? That's kind of the big picture. And while doing that, I'm kind of getting a sense of, you know, kind of where the musical problems are, right, from a practitioner's perspective. Therefore, how much time is going to be needed? How can I be useful? I'm trying to anticipate as many things as I can in order to help the process of music making. So that's kind of the main stage. And then at some point, I start marking the score. And then during that process, I'm getting deeper and deeper. Now I'm understanding, this is what Jagdish is doing.
Uh-huh.
Yes. No, so now I'm worried about, there's a shift. There's a big shift here. Also, be considerate. Be empathetic with that Richard Andrew. Be generous with that tempo. Maybe it's not 82. Maybe it's 78 for that brief. Things like this.
That's nice of you.
Yeah, but that's what being a practitioner is. I mean, you have to be considering all these elements,
practical issues.
Absolutely, and above all, you're thinking about the musical essence. Like, all these practical issues should work in the context of what's being said musically.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the process. And I try to do the same thing in the rehearsals. I try to, like, in rehearsals that we're all experts, so we can do this fast. We can just read it through and it sounds about like the piece. But also this kind of hand-holding that has to happen because I'm looking at the global picture, which not everyone is.
I mean, no, I have to admit, I don't look at every score. We can't.
Yeah. You're so busy.
The full score. But I do try sometimes. It's helpful.
Right.
But I wonder what it looks like when you practice, because for me, that's very easy. I get my bass.
Right.
I have the part. And if I don't know what something should sound like, I try to play what I'm reading and something comes out.
Right.
And I can at least piece together based on what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Maybe I have some idea of what this is going to be, but I'm just looking at one voice out of many.
Right.
And it's my job to get extremely detailed
and
very technical with that information. Your job is to coordinate that.
Yes. I mean, there's no practicing. And for me, at least at this point, I mean, I'm not looking at a mirror or, you know.
No. Well, I am, but that's my problem.
it's mostly studying. It's mostly studying the score. I spent forever. The thing about conducting is, yes, you spend a week in front of the ensemble, but you spend months with the score. You know, the majority of the time you be alone for the majority of the time.
But are you really, like, are you just reading the score like it's a book?
You're intoning it.
Or do you sit down and, like, really in real time, there's a kind of visualization process?
Not in real time, because that would be crazy. Imagine a 40-minute piece in which you're trying to do every study through is in real time. That would be...
Well, I've done that, actually, as an really? Exercise.
Really? Okay. I mean, not in real time. I mean, because things repeat, so, right? I mean, most music that's developing something, things are being repeated and things like this. So I don't have to study it again. I mean, I was trying to see if there are any changes, but you know, I can see what's happening and then contextualize that in my head. Just okay, so this is playing this role. But for the most part, I'm on planes a lot. I'm always flying. I'm always at the airport. I'm just looking at my score and I'm trying to understand each part and then put together all the parts, like trying to intone, imagine how this sound like. I'm thinking about the harmony, I'm thinking about color, I'm thinking about gesture. That's kind of maybe the biggest one, actually. I'm thinking about all aspects, trying to imagine what this moment should sound like. And yes, it's important to have a good inner ear with conducting, because that's the only way this can work, particularly new music, because you can't go to the piano, right? Imagine Ligeti, trying to do Ligeti chamber concerto at the piano, because it's possible you can play the notes,
right?
But it's crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah.
but
you can imagine. Okay, well, what's happening now? You have this line that's being played by all the woodwinds at pianissimo. You can imagine what point is trying to make here, right? And that's kind of the big idea is painting these pictures, seeing the pictures, these musical pictures. And trying to put them into context and trying to express that to the band, and then sometimes by using your words and then putting the whole picture together. That's the whole idea, I think. And then, of course, things will come up. Yeah. This is out of tune. The viola was late. Things like this. All these things will come up but that's the things you learn how to react. That's what being a professional is, right?
When it's an older piece and there's a recording, do you always check the recording?
No, not after, until I've studied it.
Okay.
I study first.
You like to do it in that order.
I want to have an interpretation first, and then I want it to become an informed interpretation.
Uh-huh.
Right. So I want to interpret, and then I'll go listen to say, okay, what's different? What's different between my performance so far and what these other conductors have done or this other conductor has done? I think otherwise I'm robbing myself of a true experience with the music.
Yep.
Yeah.
How much space do you give for the musicians to do their own interpretation?
Oh, within ensemble music, plenty.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've noticed from you.
But, that's why I call this my musical home, because that's you guys are the most flexible, most nimble. Everyone has ideas. And so creating that platform is important. Sometimes I'll say, no, I think that's a bad idea. And here's why. You can't just say no. I'm from Zimbabwe, I know, but you can't. You know, I'm used to experience, but I can't be, you know. Here's why. Because you should be the most informed, because you're looking at the score. You've studied that. You put effort into the score, but also, the cellist is also the expert at the cello part.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So there's this kind of give and take. Like, they really know how to execute their part, and they know the best ways to execute their part. And I can speak more globally about how they should contribute to the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a fine balance, I think.
So, I mean, I could imagine in our case, it's more about there's maybe too much interpretation coming, and you have to kind of balance.
That's it.
What's happening.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some disagreements between those interpretations.
Right. Yeah.
I could imagine when you're working with your students, you have the opposite problem where they're a little bit afraid to offer something.
Right.
And actually, that's my frustration watching not only student ensembles, but most orchestras. There's this very conservative approach to music making that goes all the way back to where we started. I don't know how long we've been talking.
But, right.
Where a very classical idea of this is right, this is wrong, don't make mistakes.
Right. I strictly use a Socratic method when teaching.
Uh-huh.
Always. I won't take a teaching gig, if I think there's not enough time to use the method. Because the Socratic method takes forever.
Yeah.
You can spend 2 hours just on the exposition of a Haydn symphony, let's say. So because I use the Socratic method, I'm asking questions. What do you think we should do here? Who is the theme here? Who's playing the accompaniment here? Who's secondary? What's the bass doing? What's the harmony doing here? I'm always asking these questions. For example, when I hear something out of tune, I ask people, "Oh, what chord is this?" And of course, they're going to see their part, but I'm hoping that by doing that and enforcing that, then they start to listen. Mm. I'm playing the third of this chord, so I need to tune it this way. Mm-hmm. And then it pays in dividends afterwards, after having that slow process. And I know you went to Rice, you had a great, great conductor, great teacher.
Larry Radcliffe, rest in peace. Sadly, he passed away a few months ago.
Yeah. But that kind of teaching method is what I value when teaching. So eventually, the students started having ideas. So it pays off later. But the process that we have with Ensemble Modern, that kind of process, maybe with students, it will come as a question. Mm-hmm. Should this be like this here? As opposed to say, I think this should be this.
Yeah, but I guess that's what I'm challenging a bit is that framing of, is this what it's supposed to be?
Right.
Is this correct? Can I get an A, please? do I get a gold star?
Right.
I think the terrifying thing, actually, when you're still a student, is finding out there is no right answer.
Right. Everything's relative.
It's actually a matter of taste.
Yes.
I mean, there is like right and wrong. Like if you're a bar late, you're wrong.
Right.
At some point, it becomes objective. And you can't say that was a matter of interpretation.
But that's the thing, though, about music making is that it is interpretation, right? Every performance that we hear is a result of a collective collaboration. Yep. Even when someone didn't say anything in the rehearsal. Someone should write a book about the psychology of orchestras, because there's a lot of like, when someone says nothing, that says something. It's always says something. So so every performance you hear is a result of, to a certain degree, some sort of collaboration. So it is an interpretation. It's open. Like there's no right or wrong.
No, but that's the beauty of the art form.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's my approach to every piece. So the fascinating thing about having spent so much time with scores on my own, and suddenly I'm in front of the orchestra, is that there has to be room to now your interpretation, in which you spent so much time putting effort in, being challenged, being questioned, and there has to be a dialogue. It creates, if you're healthy and you're secure, that should create a dialogue. Mm. Yeah.
Vimbai Kazaboni, you've been a wonderful guest. I love talking to you. We probably will keep talking, but at some point I have to turn the microphones off. In addition to our next performance together at the Cologne Philharmonie on the 10th of October, and these two world premieres at the Donaueschingen Musiktagen on the 16th of October, it's also the last call for the House of Call from Heiner Goebbels on the 19th of November 2022 at the Vienna Volkstheater. Vimbai, thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
That was Nebenstimmen, a podcast by Ensemble Moderne.